Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Katz, author of The Big Truck That Went By, and Jason Herbeck, French section head at Boise State University. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today we're continuing our conversation about the 2010 Haiti earthquake and its aftermath with two people who were eyewitnesses. Jonathan Katz was our guest last week, and he returns today to talk more about his award-winning book, The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Mr. Katz was the only full-time U.S. news reporter in Haiti when the quake struck. Later on today's program, we'll talk with Jason Herbeck, a Boise State University French professor who was in Haiti in 2010 when the quake struck. He has since visited the country to continue his research. Let's start by talking with Jonathan Katz about the cholera epidemic that struck Haiti 10 months after the January 2010 quake. Mr. Katz broke the story that United Nations soldiers likely caused the outbreak, which has now claimed more than 10,000 lives. Despite overwhelming evidence that the source of the outbreak was wastewater from a UN base that contaminated a nearby river, the United Nations has so far refused to claim responsibility. On last week's program, I asked Jonathan to explain what was behind the United Nations position, and we'll pick up our conversation with that question. And you actually quote the UN Special Envoy, none other than former President Bill Clinton, who said that a UN soldier from South Asia, from Nepal, carried the cholera strain from Nepal to Haiti. Does the UN still fight that assertion?
Yes. So Bill Clinton only was willing to say that once once my reporting was out in the world, once there was the French epidemiologist Renaud Pirot, who had been brought in by the United Nations once his report was leaked to me and published. It took a while. And by the way, Hillary has also said in her memoir that is the likely thing that happened. But what both of them say that follows that up immediately is that there should be no accountability, that nobody should be held responsible for the negligence that caused the deaths of 10,000 people so far and counting. People are still dying of this disease in Haiti.
Why? Why did they say that?
Because they don't want anybody to be held responsible. Frankly, within the United Nations organization, at very, very high levels, there is a good appreciation of what they did and a sense that something needs to be done to make it right. The Secretary General of the UN continues to deny. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has spoken of a moral responsibility, which is a legally crafted term to explain that there's no actual responsibility. I mean, essentially, it's a meaningless phrase. But the UN continues to deny. But frankly, one of the major reasons why the UN continues to deny is because of pressure from the United States government, because the United States government, the Obama administration, is not interested in any kind of accountability for the UN or its peacekeepers. The two big reasons are because, first of all, if a legal precedent is created in which soldiers who are under a status of forces agreement as peacekeepers in a country can be held responsible for negligence, then that could leave lots of other United Nations peacekeepers on the hook for things like sexual abuse and other kinds of malfeasance. It could also affect United States troops that are in places like Afghanistan under similar status of forces agreements. And if the bill has to be paid to clean this up and build the water and sanitation infrastructure that's necessary to stem the tide of the epidemic, the United States contributes about a quarter of the funding to United Nations peacekeeping. So the U.S. is not interested in paying this money. Mm-hmm. Frankly, the world and this goes back to what we were originally talking about how money flows and doesn't flow in the wake of a disaster like the earthquake. You know, for all our big talk and for all of our supposed generosity, and we can be generous in places, we do not want to hand over money. We do not want to spend money in other places in ways that are more immediately going to benefit the people who actually live in those places than is going to benefit us. And the cholera epidemic is just a screaming example of an instance where the international community has done horrific harm and refuses to do anything to make it right, refuses to even say the words, "I'm sorry," because it's too difficult. And it's much, much easier to just sort of sit back and allow people to assume that Haiti is this disease dirty country where bad things like cholera just happen to happen, and allow that to be the end of the conversation. But, you know, unfortunately for them, there are a couple of people, journalists like me and some others who continue banging the pot and bringing this topic up, even though it's been uncomfortable for 5.5 years.
Yeah. And those of us who read your book and agree with what you're doing here, in April of 2016, you actually wrote for Slate about the CDC's, the Center for Disease Control's, refusal to pinpoint the source of the outbreak. Is that some kind of a direct order? Again, spinning off of what you're talking about here, some kind of direct order coming from the U.S. government that, you know, you can't go near it because we do not want accountability to be held here?
Well, there's still no answer to, you know, the Watergate question, right, about what did people know and when did they know it, right? Yeah. I mean, there isn't a recording of a stand-down order, to use a, from another conspiracy theory, about why exactly things went the way that they did. But what we do know is that this CDC violated its own protocols on how to respond to a water and foodborne epidemic by not trying to investigate the point source. I mean, it was very, very strange. Because, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm the Associated Press correspondent in Port-au-Prince, and I'm mucking around and I'm looking for the source. But that shouldn't have been my job. And it wasn't my – I mean, it was my job to try to follow up on the rumors. But the work that should have been done by epidemiologists with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It should have been done by the World Health Organization. It should have been done by anybody who is trying to stop the epidemic. And they didn't. As far as we know, they didn't look for a second to try to figure out what the point source of the epidemic was. Paul Farmer, who, by the way, was Bill Clinton's deputy at the United Nations at the time and obviously a renowned doctor and humanitarian worker in his own right, he said at the time that sounded to him like politics and not science. So it's very strange why the CDC wouldn't have looked for the source. And sometimes I think that the only reason why the UN and the CDC wouldn't have gone looking for the source of cholera in Haiti in the fall of 2010 is because they already knew what it was.
Jonathan, I'd like you to comment on the Paul Collier report as a way of getting to the issue of what does Haiti do next to recover, to reconstruct. They have a garment industry fledgling at the moment, and Collier's report suggests that we should get this thing off the ground. But there's some real hang-ups with that, given the fact that currently that garment industry is paying very poor wages.
Right, sure. I mean, so very briefly, Paul Collier is a very famous economist from Oxford. He was the author of a book called The Bottom Billion, which a lot of people who are interested in global poverty and development have read. And he was brought in to Haiti. This was before the earthquake. He was brought in, I guess it was 2009. To investigate how it would be possible for Haiti's economy to develop. It was already an extremely impoverished country, right? People say Haiti's the only country in the world with the last name, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So there's a reason for that. And he was brought in by Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations that we were just talking about, to investigate how it would be possible for Haiti's economy to develop. Now, Paul Collier is an expert on a lot of things, but he had never been to Haiti before. He knew nothing about Haiti. And he came in and he wrote a very brief report. I think it was 19 pages long. And it had several different prescriptions, but the big one was to scale up Haiti's low-wage assembly sector. And this is a sector that had been big in Haiti in the 1970s and the early 1980s. Those who are listening who are old enough may remember that there was a time when every single baseball used in the major leagues in the United States said "Made in Haiti" on it, because people would sew them in these factories for very, very little money. And clothes are, of course, made the same way. Very tight margins, and so you want to pay your workers as little as possible. And in Haiti, people can pay their workers as little as possible. And Collier was recommending scaling up the garment sector. Bill Clinton became the special envoy for Haiti, specifically to implement the Collier report. Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, also had that as sort of the centerpiece of her vision of how Haiti's economy could develop. It's a very popular vision in the United States for countries in other parts of the world. It's a very sort of top-down way of thinking about things. If you imagine that people have absolutely nothing, you imagine that people have absolutely no work and that there's just absolutely nothing else that they could do, they'll be happy for anything that we give them. So if we throw them, you know, a couple pennies an hour to sew our clothes, they'll be happy and we'll get cheap clothes and everybody benefits in the end. Of course, that's not what actually happens.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Katz about his book, The Big Truck That Went By. The book is a firsthand account of the deadliest quake in the history of the Western Hemisphere and its devastating aftermath. How realistic is this vision that by creating low-wage jobs in the garment industry, a country will be able to pull itself out of poverty?
If you look at other places in the world, such as Bangladesh, where this low-wage textile industry is thriving, workers are miserable, buildings collapse, there's a complete lack of protection for workers. And it's the same in Haiti. There was no unionization. The companies who came in from the outside were allowed to repatriate 100% of their profits without paying any taxes into Haiti. And what ends up happening is that after the earthquake, the United States constructs a garment factory industrial park in the north of Haiti with a price tag of about $300 million paid for by you and me in the United States to basically provide land and buildings and roads and a power plant and other infrastructure for garment companies to come in and have low-paid labor.
You visited a factory in Haiti owned by a South Korean firm where hundreds of workers were making suits that would sell for $500 in their catalog. One young woman there sewed the sleeves on suit jackets and made only enough each day to buy a cupful of rice and a few other basics like transportation. She also was sleeping on the streets and was a long way from having a sustainable situation. Can you talk about that?
So you were referring to one of the workers that I talked to. I've talked to a lot of them over the years. And, you know, they'll usually tell you about the same thing, which is that, you know, yes, they are happy for the job that they have. It's not so much a question of them having no other options of work, but people are looking for steady work. They're hoping that if they can go work for, you know, some kind of international firm, that it will be a promise of a job that's going to stick around for a while and that maybe there'll be a chance for advancement, maybe there'll be a chance for more money. But of course, there generally isn't, because the entire point of the garment industry is that you pay the people who are doing the sewing for you as little as possible so you can keep the clothes as cheap as possible, so you can have the largest profit margins possible while still selling the clothes as cheap as possible in American stores. And when the wages start to go up, when there's pressure to actually pay people more, that's when the garment factories tend to close and move to another country where they can pay workers that cheaply. So right now there's a lot of talk going around about, because of the presidential election in the United States, about the episode in 2009 where Haitian lawmakers were trying to raise the minimum wage, and there was extensive pressure from the United States Embassy, from the State Department, which of course was headed by Hillary Clinton, and which is why this is a political issue in the United States right now. And they came in and they said, absolutely not. I mean, they put pressure on the president to, I think the words of one of the cables that was leaked was to resolve the issue. And the president at the time, Rene Préval, acted completely unconstitutionally and basically redrafted the provision and sent it back to parliament. There was no constitutional provision for that. The United States had nothing bad to say about that. They were fine with it, and it ended up going through as a compromise position that did raise the minimum wage slightly, but not nearly as much as lawmakers had asked. It's gone up more since then.
What are the long-term ramifications of the Collier Report? Can you comment on what the international community learned, or what should we have learned in Haiti that might help us the next time a disaster strikes?
The basic point is that looking at Haiti through the lens of the Collier Report, looking at Haiti through the lens of this industry as the key to the country's growth, is very much a symptom of a philosophy in which we sit in the United States and look at the rest of the world as being primarily a producer for our needs. And we imagine that people will be better off, that people will be happier as long as they're in these jobs that we can recognize because they're making things for us to buy at Target and at Kmart and at Walmart and et cetera. And really, when you look at the effects of those policies around the world, and especially in places like Haiti, they have contributed to poverty, they have contributed to weakness, they have contributed to weakening the state. And it is one of the major reasons why people were so poor, why it was impossible to count how many people were in the areas that were affected by the earthquake, why it was impossible to have building codes that could have built buildings strong enough to withstand the earthquake, and one of the major reasons why 100,000 people to 316,000 people died 6 years ago in the first place. So if we're really serious, if we really want to stop disasters like these from happening again in the future, because there's no reason why a city should not be able to survive a 7.0 earthquake. Cities survive those things all the time. Then we have to think about the mistakes that we've made in the past, the mistakes that we continue making, the mistakes that we're making right now while this conversation is going on, how to fix that, how to change accountability, how to change these visions, how to change philosophies, and actually do things differently from now on so that the next time a disaster like that strikes, it won't be nearly as deadly.
Jonathan, that really sums it up. Thank you so much for joining us today. I got to tell you that we've barely covered the surface here, and I strongly urge our listeners to get a copy of this and think long and seriously about this issue that Jonathan has just raised. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks. It's been a great conversation.
Jonathan Katz. Again, the name of the book is The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. We're going to continue talking about Haiti for the remainder of today's program with my guest, Jason Herbeck. Dr. Herbeck is a professor of French and French section head in the Department of World Languages at Boise State University. And he was in Haiti when the earthquake struck in 2010. I talked with Dr. Herbeck then about his experiences in Haiti, including what he witnessed on the ground and how he managed to get a flight back to Boise during those early chaotic days. I've invited him to our studios today to reflect back on the quake and its aftermath and talk a bit about Jonathan Katz's book and what experiences he found returning to Haiti later. Jason Herbeck, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Well, Jason, I said that you returned later. I think it was in 2013 you went back to Haiti for a conference. Tell us about the conference. Most importantly, what you saw when you arrived. It was certainly a little different anyway than when you had to leave so suddenly after the earthquake. And then perhaps we'll get into a conversation about this documentary that you actually saw at the conference.
Yes, my trip back was in 2013 for the Haitian Studies Association Conference, the 25th annual conference, which is usually held somewhere in North America or the Caribbean. And they decided that for the 25th anniversary, they would have it back in Haiti as a means of trying to demonstrate that reconstruction was taking place. And as it turned out, the conference was held at the same hotel I was at during the earthquake, the Caribe Hotel. The first thing I wanted to do when I checked into the hotel was go up to my room, put my stuff down, and go back out to the exact same area where I was trying to type an email to my wife when the earthquake hit. And I can tell you my heart was racing until I'd actually sent send. I pushed send, and I knew that it was not going to repeat itself at that moment, mm-hmm. so it felt good. Mm-hmm. The conference, this Haitian Studies Association is a very diverse conference. It's not just a literary conference. They have public policy experts, people studying agriculture, education. And so it was at that moment that I was able to see one of the keynote speakers, including Paul Farmer, but also Raoul Peck, this filmmaker from Haiti.
Mm-hmm. And the name of that documentary is Fatal Assistance?
Fatal Assistance.
Tell us about the documentary and how it jibes with what we learned from our interview with Jonathan Katz and his book, The Big Truck That Went By.
Raoul Peck explained at the beginning of his talk that he was granted pretty much unlimited access to all the meetings that were taking place in Haiti after the earthquake. And soon after the earthquake, there was a commission started. It was the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission. And it was partly organized by René Préval, the president of Haiti at the time, and Bill Clinton. And because there was such optimism on the ground in Haiti and so much money had been donated to the reconstruction effort, basically I think they thought, as Raoul Peck explained, that there was no risk in having him assist in all of these meetings and have much footage, et cetera. And over the course of the documentary, we see just to what extent the optimism was poorly founded and things started going from bad to worse.
Mm-hmm. And I know it's difficult to break out exactly why it went from bad to worse, but I think I remember something about the fact that the NGOs didn't trust government officials in Haiti because there had been plenty of corruption in Haiti's past. And yet when the NGOs received all this money from people like ourselves back in the States, interested in donating to the cause, they literally couldn't ramp it up fast enough. As I remember, the Red Cross in particular literally didn't have anything in place to take care of the earthquake victims, and yet they had a lot of money to do it with.
Yeah, OPEC explains in the documentary something that I wasn't aware of at the time, and that's that a lot of the money came with conditions. And these big associations, countries that wanted to donate to the cause, wanted to see their money put towards reconstruction. And they didn't realize that before any reconstruction could take place, they needed to actually remove tons of debris from Port-au-Prince and the surrounding area. And as Raoul Peck explains in the documentary, that wasn't a very flashy means of showing how the funds were spent. And so a lot of the red tape in place right from the start had to do with the fact that the money was reserved for certain projects that simply couldn't start until things were taken, all the debris and the rubble was taken away from Port-au-Prince.
You know, as I listened to Jonathan Katz describe the situation, and of course he deals with this extensively in his book, I couldn't help but think about all the people that write checks to organizations like the Red Cross in times of need and what they're going to do next time. I mean, if they read a book like Katz's book or if they see a documentary like Fatal Assistance, it, I think, raises some real serious questions about how much can be raised in future episodes like this when there was such chaos in this one.
I think that's a great question, and it's a great concern. Watching the news, reading the Haitian papers, talking with my Haitian colleagues and friends, yes, in disasters like this, money is needed, but when we see the fact that all this money given is not going to the right people and to the right projects, it does create a huge question as to how to give, how to help.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and we're talking about the 2010 Haiti earthquake and its aftermath. Earlier on today's program, I spoke with Jonathan Katz, author of The Big Truck That Went By, and now I'm speaking with Jason Herbeck, who is the French section head at Boise State University. Dr. Herbeck was in Haiti in 2010 when the earthquake struck, and he has since visited the country to continue his research. So let's talk a little bit about Haiti's leadership, and of course, the person in Haiti's history that probably gets so much of the attention and is best known, famous or infamous would probably be a better word, is Baby Doc Duvalier. Could you tell us a little bit about him, about perhaps Haitian leadership in general, and then what happens when he returns, and ultimately what happens?
Baby Doc, Jean-Claude Duvalier was the son of François Duvalier, who took power in 1957. And soon after taking power, he proclaimed himself president for life. And when he did, many things in Haiti started to change. And there was a coup d'etat against him. And so he immediately decided that the army did not have a place in Haiti. And he constructed basically his own paramilitary groups called the Tonton Macoute, who became essentially hitmen working for him and spreading fear among the Haitian population. Shortly before he died, he changed the constitution once more and allowed himself to proclaim his successor, who was his son, Baby Doc. And Baby Doc, in many ways, followed in the way of his father until the Haitian people no longer could support what he was doing, and they revolted, and Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier left the country in 1986. He went to France for 25 years of exile, approximately, and then to everyone's astonishment, he came back to Haiti roughly a year after the Haitian earthquake in 2011. And at that point, there was international outrage based on what he had done during his time in power in Haiti. Mm-hmm. The Haitian people, interestingly enough, did not react as one might think. Upwards of 60% of the Haitian population is 25 years or younger. And so they did not remember his era. And what they do remember is the fact that the economy was better at the time that he left, despite the fact that he left the country with millions of dollars of the Haitian people. And so roughly 30 people pressed charges against him once he came back, charges against international crimes against humanity. And it was really difficult to see how little was done. Okay, he was found. He was in cafes downtown in Pétionville, near Port-au-Prince, dining out when he was supposed to be under house arrest. It was clear that the measures weren't being taken to have justice in his case. And eventually he was, he did have a couple hearings, but then he died of a heart attack in 2014. And at that point, it's almost as if this mystique in Haitian society is still there now because there are no answers. During his hearing, he adamantly proclaimed that he was always helping the Haitian people. And so there are two sides to the story that remain in many regards unresolved.
So your experience in Haiti, living through the earthquake, getting out of the country just in time, so to speak, returning later, the documentary Fatal Assistance, this all finds itself in your classes here at Boise State. I'm interested in the reaction students have to all of this, the conversations you have with students, what topics surround your discussions as you delve into this and help students understand the role that this all plays in their education here at Boise State.
As a professor, I want to share my passion with my students. And so I do teach several courses where I'm able to present Haiti, Haitian literature, Haitian culture, and Haitian history to my students. The biggest struggle that I have as a professor is presenting this in a way that does not leave my students entirely depressed and disappointed and thinking that there's no hope for this country. And one of the ways in which I do that is to, in addition to the history that we discuss, that we read about, is to read literature. I think literature is a fundamental perspective. By looking at literature, we see perspectives that are often drowned out in the mass media. And there is optimism within that literature, and there's always struggle. And I was very fortunate enough to have Evelyne Trouillot, one of the major Haitian writers, come to Boise prior to the earthquake. And we were reading several of her novels for the class. And to answer your question, one of my students asked her point blank, how can you keep writing such sad stories? And her response was beautiful. She lit up and said, I don't see them as sad. When there's struggle, there's optimism, and therefore I write about happiness. Mm-hmm. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And we often Skype with Haitian writers from Haiti and from the diaspora living in the United States, for example, and it provides a very personal context where my students can ask those difficult questions that I may have answers to, but they would be definitely not nearly as convincing as someone who has lived there their entire life, mm-hmm. or gone to the United States during the Duvalier regime, for example, and decided to move back to Haiti because that is their homeland.
So give us an example of the kinds of readings that you were covering in class with the visit of this Haitian author.
Most interesting is to look at the way in which literature changed after the earthquake, because many authors did not want to discuss the earthquake. They didn't know how to approach it. And so there is now what has been termed a post-earthquake literature of Haiti, where writers eventually come to grapple with this issue in their own creative spheres. And one text in particular that has really found a place with my students is a text by a writer named Yannick Lins, and she wrote a text called Faille, which translates roughly to faults. On the one hand, it's a series of narratives that she puts together after the earthquake, and she's driving around Port-au-Prince trying to understand what has happened to the capital, her home. And as she's talking about the geological shifts, the fractures of Haitian society, she's also looking back and suggesting that there are infrastructural, educational, social fissures in Haitian society that made this earthquake so devastating. And there's a particular passage which for me really hits home because I study literature and Haitian contemporary history, history and contemporary society. And she decides to survey the damage around her home. She goes for a drive in her car, and she goes to this neighborhood where she had imagined two of her fictional characters in a future novel meeting. And in her narrative in Fai, she jams on the brakes and explains how she reverses the car, goes back, and she does not recognize the street in which she had imagined this love story because it is so destroyed, and the house in which she'd imagined the relationship beginning has entirely slid off the mountain and disappeared. And so she tries to, within her novel, pull her fictional characters from the literal rubble, which is just a powerful image in terms of how authors have to grapple with real events and find their own ways of overcoming them.
Well, Jason, we wish you the very best in your future travels to Haiti and your work here at Boise State. We're delighted to have you with us. And again, it's Jason Herbeck, professor of French and the French section head at the Department of World Languages at Boise State University. Thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much.
And thanks again to Jonathan Katz, author of The Big Truck That Went By, who joined us for the first part of today's program and who also was featured on last week's show. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. Our engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent interviews, including my conversation with NPR's Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan about The Great Gatsby, you can find them on our iTunes player and on our website. To download our free player, go to the iTunes App Store and search for Reader's Corner. Interviews also are posted on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.